Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski. In this episode, which is episode 3 of season 5, we're going to be talking about 6 stories. We're talking about, should you sell your house now before the National Association of Realtors settlement kicks in, or should you sell afterwards? We're also going to discuss what's going on in South Florida. Why is the job market here so much stronger than it is the rest of the country? We'll take a look at Ultra. Ultra's that music festival that just went on in downtown Miami. We're going to take a look. Were there a bunch of arrests? We saw what happened during spring break. What about Ultra? Another story we're going to take a look at is condo buyouts. Some of these old buildings, which are being forced to sell out because dues are getting too high, insurance is too high. Well, now there seems to be some sort of legal ease that's jammed up a deal that's in the process. And what is that going to mean for owners of old condominium units? And then also, too, we'll take a look at interest rates. Interest rates were supposed to come down. Well, the 10-year treasury is still at 4.25%. Credit card interest rates are high. And what is the outlook for that? And then finally, we're going to wrap up the podcast with a story taking a look at what else but fraud with condo association. So stay tuned. After the break, we'll go ahead and get into our stories.
Welcome to the CondoVultures.com podcast with your host, Peter Zalewski, a Miami real estate broker, Wall Street consultant, and expert witness. This podcast is focused on identifying real estate buying opportunities in the South Florida condo market, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. The CondoVultures.com podcast is not authorized by the South Florida real estate industry and will most likely annoy many of the region's talking heads. This podcast will feature straight talk and salty language that could be offensive to some. Please remember that past investment success does not determine future gains, especially in South Florida's volatile condo market. For more information, please visit CondoVultures.com.
Don't buy a South Florida condo, discounted or distressed, before taking a Condo Vultures correction tour. CondoVultures.com offers weekly bus and walking tours that focus on educating buyers on the how-tos of identifying discounted condos, analyzing the opportunities, and purchasing units. Every tour attendee receives a list of all condo projects in a particular market, a market assessment handout, and unmatched expert analysis. For more information on the condo correction tours, please visit condovultures.eventbrite.com.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast, and I wanted to alert you that if you have a property that you're looking to sell in the Tri-County South Florida area, I would encourage you to reach out to Jenny Cortez, a licensed real estate broker with CVRRealty.com. She's my partner. She's been in the business for north of 15 years. More importantly, she knows the market. She knows how to get a deal done. And she also realizes that it's more important to get a price that you can accept and sell the property rather than to hold firm on some price that's never going to be achieved and ultimately languish on the market. So if you're looking to do a deal that you want a skilled expert who can help you sell a property, reach out to Jenny Cortez at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859, or visit her website, CVRRealty.com. Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. If you're tuning in to this podcast, you're going to hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories that have occurred within the last week. The objective of the podcast is to cut through some of the hyperbole, some of the fluff that's out there, and give you the audience an idea of what might really be going on. I am joined by 3 journalists on this podcast. I've sent them all off stories, 2 stories each, asked them to give them a read. And then what we're going to do is we're going to discuss each story with the idea of trying to figure out what's kind of really going on. Let's read between the lines, if you will. So let me go ahead and introduce you to the members of the podcast this week. We have a gentleman who's been a journalist or was a journalist for over 25 years, where now he has his own public relations and marketing firm called Gruss Communications. You can check out his website, grusspr.com, G-R-U-S-S-P-R.com. No one else but John Gruss. Check him out on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at John Gruss, J-E-A-N-G-R-U-S-S. Mr. Gruss, what's going on?
Hey, it's great to be back on the Unauthorized Podcast and back on season 5. And is this podcast even legal? I mean, we haven't been shut down. We haven't been shut down yet, and we're still going at it. And I'm glad to be back.
Don't even bring up that word. We are in the state of Florida. The legislature just approved legislation that's now going to stop people under a certain age. I think it's 14 from being able to use social media. A lot of books are getting banned in this state. So I don't want you to bring up that ever again, John, if possible.
Okay, Peter. But
perfect.
I'm just looking out for you, man.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And who else do we have on the podcast this week? We have a gentleman, a journalist for over 20 years. Right now, it is public relations in marketing. No one else but John Fackler. If you want to get a hold of John, you can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at JT Fackler, JT Fackler. Mr. Fackler is our resident expert when it comes to anything social gatherings. He's talked a lot about spring break over the course of the 5 years of the podcast. We're going to ask him this week to talk about Ultra, that electronic dance music festival that went on in downtown Miami. Mr. Fackler, what's going on? And by the way, did you make it out to Ultra this year?
No, I did not make it to Ultra this year, but it was so loud. I'm able to hear it here in Shenandoah, miles away. But, I'm certainly glad to be back on the podcast, the authentic and non-AI podcast with a bunch of real people. So happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, Mr. Fackler. And who's our visiting journalist this week? We have a gentleman who's a journalist for over 15 years. Right now, he's in the financial tech industry. No one else but a gentleman named Forrest Jones. If you want to reach out to Forrest, you can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at AFJ3, AFJ3. What's going on, Forrest?
Hey, Peter, thanks so much. It's great to be back here. I really love your podcast. Very few podcasts where we can talk about interest rates, Ultra, and soccer stadiums.
And Forrest, you're actually an author as well. You published a book. You're working on a second book. Mm-hmm. Why don't you go ahead and give the audience an idea what the books are about and where they might be able to purchase them?
Sure. The book's called, the first one's called The Placebo Agenda. I got a copy right here. You can get it on Amazon or pretty much any channel you want. It's a first installment of the Street Brewer mystery thrillers. Actually, this one takes place in Venezuela and Miami, based on my time when I was a reporter in Venezuela and Miami. And I'm currently at work on a second one, the second Street Brewer thriller. Street Brewer could be on here. He was a journalist himself. And the second one will take place in the Middle East, where I have work experience as well.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Well, that should be fun. And I'd encourage everybody in the audience to go ahead and check out the check out Forrest's books. So before we go ahead and get into our stories, let me just sort of lay out the rules of engagement. As mentioned, I went ahead and I handpicked six stories. I sent them off to the journalists, two stories each, asked them to give them the read. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through, we're going to read the headlines, we're going to read the first couple graphs, and last the journalist to comment. After the first commenter goes, then the floor is open and anybody else can sort of chime in. The objective of the podcast is to cut through the fluff and give you straight talk. Let me encourage you, if you have any comments for us, you have any questions, go ahead and reach out to us on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. It is not AARP, so we might look older, but we don't, not all of us qualify for AARP. So remember, Miami RRP. And in terms of sponsorship for this podcast, the sponsor is actually my firm, condovultures.com, condovultures.com. If you're looking for anything related to condos, whether it's statistics, analysis, brokerage services, whether you need buy side or sell side, anything like that, I encourage you to check out condovultures.com. And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter. We put out a weekly newsletter. It's hitting 16,000 people every week. We provide some proprietary information. So if you need condo stats, we might be a good source for your information, desires, and demands. So that being said, let's go ahead and we're going to get into our podcast. John Gruce, we're going to go to you with story number one. This is a piece that's coming out of CNN. I'm going to read you the headline. I'm going to read you the first couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Let me sort of set the scene before I go ahead and read the headline. This month, the National Association of Realtors, they reached they worked out a settlement where basically they agreed to pay about $418 million over the course of the next 4 years, and they're going to change their commission structure. Previously, anybody who listed a property with their realtor nationwide, the sell side, the listing side, would typically offer a commission to anybody bringing in a buyer, a realtor, a club member of the National Association of Realtors who brought in a buyer, and therefore a commission would be offered, and both sides would sort of split the commission. Well, as a result of the settlement, that's no longer the case. A settlement was reached, and come July, in theory, this settlement could go into effect if a judge signs off on it. So that's the background, John. Let me go ahead and read you the first couple graphs in the headline. Headline, should you sell your home now or wait for the realtor settlement this summer? And then the first couple graphs, Sean, then I'll ask you to comment. Listing your home in the spring used to be a no-brainer, but a major real estate shakeup is complicating the equation. That shakeup's coming from a $418 million settlement the National Association of Realtors announced last week with groups of home sellers that could go into effect as early as July. The settlement will eliminate the longstanding standard of 6% commissions paid by the seller, which could ultimately make it cheaper to sell your home post-settlement. But is it worth waiting to list your home and potentially risking a sale? John, why don't you give us your take? What does the story lay out? And then what's your interpretation of sort of everything you're hearing and everything you're reading?
Well, I think all things being equal, yeah, you should definitely wait. I mean, if you don't have to sell your house now, absolutely you should wait because I think everyone will agree that the commission structure as it is now will be going away, and home sellers are going to save a lot of money on the sale and the commissions to real estate agents. And so if you could wait a couple months, you might benefit. Now, you know, Florida's in a unique situation somewhat because, you know, typically we're going, you know, in July, July, August is really the start of the slow season. It's hurricane season. You know, that might sway your decision. But if you don't have to sell, I would definitely, wait around because I think everybody agrees that home sellers are going to benefit.
Now, Jean, up until this settlement went to, basically was announced, the general way that real estate worked, if you hired a realtor, and keep in mind, if you have a real estate license, once you have that real estate license, you go ahead and you join a club called the Realtor Association. And once you join the Realtor Association, your primary reason to drop your $1,000 a year to become a member or to be a member is you get to use this multiple listing survey, which is a database that realtors use to go ahead and market properties. And then Zillow and other websites, they go ahead and they tap into this this resource, if you will, which is the MLS, and they go ahead and they market the properties elsewhere. Now, come July, if the settlement goes into effect, only would a seller have to offer commission to another realtor. So in theory, right now, if you list your property, you're probably paying 6% commission if you're the seller. But come July, you might only have to offer 3% commission. So what does that mean? That means a $100,000 sale. In theory, right now, you have to pay a 6% commission. You could offer $3,000 commission. That seems like quite the incentive for
me. No, that's exactly right.
And that's why you should wait. Am I getting the right shot, or did I mix something up there? Now, let me go ahead and open the floor. Let me open it to Forrest and Mr. Fackler as well. Gentlemen, if you were in the market for a condo or a property in South Florida, how do you think it would look from the buy side? Do you think there's any reason to move now, maybe while there's still chaos, the settlement hasn't been signed off yet on a judge by a judge? Or do you think it makes more sense on a buy side perspective to also sit back? So you can see why the seller makes sense to not necessarily list your property today because you could save half the commission. But what about on the buy side? Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Well, if I was in the market, I'm a renter right now, but I was a homeowner. But if I was in the market as a buyer, I would try to hustle a little bit and see if I can get some sort of a deal while the chaos is going on in the market. But other than that, you know, I'd sort of completely stay away from this whole buy-sell side. I just continue to rent.
Continue to rent. And Forrest, any thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would wait. I'm a renter myself. Would like to buy one day. I would wait and see if I could save. I would. The thing about real estate, from what I understand, is that it if it's going down, it tends to bounce along a bottom for a little while. So you do have that luxury right now, theoretically, you know, to wait and see how it goes.
You know, and that's kind of interesting if I could just throw it out there. But basically about July of 2023 is when a lot of the interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve started to kick in. We started to see a slowing in the marketplace and ultimately a freezing of the market, where now you got a lot more product available. You don't have the transactions going on. So in theory, if everybody's sitting back waiting, we could have gone a year. Basically a year of bleeding out the market where no transactions are going on, A, because of interest rates, B, because prices got too high. You got the insurance crisis going out, but now you even got the National Association of Realtors settlement, which is creating all this other confusion. Do you think that this is possibly the worst of times for realtors and it's only going to get better? Or is this likely just the beginning of what could be some sort of correction? Anybody want to take that?
Well, do you think there's going to be, it makes sense, it'd be an increase in inventory. And if there's an increase in inventory, that's going to affect the pricing. So it might be, you know, it might be difficult to get a good deal. Or maybe I'm not a real estate person, but maybe it's better for a buyer. to sit back and wait. There's more inventory now. The seller's going to bring their prices down. And maybe that's a chance to pounce.
Look at Mr. Fackler. Mr. Fackler says he didn't know anything about real estate. That to me sounds like a discount buyer in the making. Well done, Mr. Fackler. Well done. Okay, story number two. Horace Jones, we're going to go to you with story number two. This piece coming out of WLRN, which is the NPR affiliate down here in South Florida. I'll read you the headline. I'll read you the first couple graphs for us, and I want you to comment. Headline, work and wine, colon, South Florida's job market inflation keep outpacing the nation. First couple graphs go like this. Got milk? If so, it's probably cheaper than it was a year ago, but a glass of wine likely costs you more. Dairy products was one of the few grocery groups to actually fall in price in February compared to a year earlier, according to new regional inflation figures released Tuesday by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Alcoholic beverage prices, however, they were up 8.8% in February in South Florida. South Florida continues to experience the highest inflation in the nation, while also one of the hottest job markets yet. Wage growth has slowed considerably from the first years of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here's a closer look at the February statistics released this week. Mr. Jones, in going through the article, what would you say the takeaway is? Why is South Florida's inflation rate high? It's some of the, one of the highest in the country, as well as the jobs. Why are we doing so well? You would think it'd be one or the other, but somehow both of them are going upward.
Oh yeah, people are moving here. Industries that weren't here a few years ago are, you know, financial technology. Certain areas of finance are here. If you look at jobless figures, the February jobless figure was jobless was 2.4 in South Florida. Compare that to 3.9 nationwide. If you look at our inflation rate, it's 4.9 in February compared to 3.2. You know, a lot of that's fueled by rent, home, and as you point, alcoholic drinks and other drinks. You know, the economy's on firm footing. People are has some legs beneath it. People are moving here. You know, what's going forward on that? You know, the Fed has stopped raising interest rates. When will it cut? That's the thing. Most people are thinking for 3 moves this year. But consumer prices are still a little high. So, you know, it's with people relocating, you know, it's a great place to be. And if new industries, that's the thing. Now with South Florida, can it continue this? Is the South Florida economy, is it more diversified than it was a few years ago? Absolutely. But is it still somewhat, how do I word this, heavily reliant on tourism and real estate? There's probably more room for improvement there. So as of right now, it looks like, you know, it's defying national trends. Wouldn't be the first time South Florida has done that.
Interesting. Let me ask you a follow-up question. Generally speaking, I've always heard that the stock market is giving you an indication of 6 months in the future, and the unemployment rate or the labor statistics are 6 months in the past, if you will. So, you know, that's looking backwards, and the stock market kind of looks forward. Here we are in March. Prices are high, but I've noticed at the grocery store, some stuff is starting to come down. What's your gut feel as somebody who was born and raised in South Florida? You've seen a lot of ups and downs over the course of your lifetime. What's the sense you get now that the winter buying season is over? It's going to wrap up in April. Would you expect things to continue going downward as we get into at least the local feel as we get into the summer? Or do you think that we're still positioned for strong prices going forward?
I think prices will cool. They have been cooling, and they will. I think the good news here, and you know, I can get to this later, is that we as our monetary authorities are they steering us away from a recession down the road? It looks like they probably will. So if things cool a little bit, if we get corrections, That's a much welcome alternative than what we're hearing a year ago in sort of inflation. And then as far as loose monetary policies reverberating in South Florida and abroad, it's been rough. People have felt it nationwide, but we certainly haven't seen these cries of hyperinflation and things like that by any means. I think galloping would be at 10%. Things to go higher. So, so for all practical purpose, things have been pretty tough in Florida and here, but, you know, things will cool, I think. And, you know, we'll see from there.
Well,
it hasn't been that.
I'm sorry, Forrest, I didn't mean to interrupt, but, you know, this is sort of for the floor. You know, what I gauge the economy by is happy hours. I look at happy hours. I'm an avid believer. As happy hours are offered, that basically reflects what's going on. If the market is strong, there's no freaking happy hours. If the market is struggling or people don't have as much cash to burn, or the restaurants, and granted, every restaurant's different, every bar's different, but if the restaurant's struggling, they want cash flow, they need to keep the lights on and keep the employees busy, they're going to offer some happy hours. I've seen some happy hours from places I would not have expected. Anybody have any thoughts about the happy hour perspective?
We're going to see a lot of restaurant closures because there's been a downturn in the restaurant and bar business. Especially, you know, for reasons unrelated to the economy, but perhaps like in Miami Beach, with the curfews, spring break curfews and all that. And, now that season is over, I mean, next Monday is Easter. That's basically the end of season and all the snowbirds are heading back. So, I think restaurants that have been sort of teetering on the edge, they're going to be closing in the next couple of months. And I think that's going to be a telltale sign of the slowdown, basically.
I agree. I'm noticing you're not seeing as many details on Uber Eats anymore. There was a point where they were giving 40% off and all these restaurants were jumping in. You're not seeing a lot of discounts anymore from restaurants.
Mr. Factor, I'm going to go to you with story number three. This piece is coming out of Local10.com, which is the ABC affiliate down here in South Florida. Has to do with Ultra. Ultra is this electronic dance music festival that's held annually down here in Miami. And it basically kind of represents sort of, it's one of the symbolic ends to the winter season, much like Easter or Passover would be. This is like one of the last big events where everybody comes rolling to the town for. So, Mr. Fracker, I'll read you the headline first, a couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline, Ultra Music Festival ends with few arrests in downtown Miami, police said. Subhead, Biscayne Boulevard near Bayfront Park reopened Monday morning. And first couple graphs, the Ultra Music Festival ended on Sunday night with few related arrests in downtown Miami. According to Officer Kiara Delva, spokeswoman for the Miami Police Department, there weren't any UMF related arrests on Friday, and there were only four arrests on Saturday and three on Sunday. Delva reported the cases were for illegal vending, theft, and trespassing. The festival's beat of electronic dance music lasted longer on Saturday night than on Friday, when the organizers had to end it early because of stormy weather. Sunday had the shortest schedule. UMF organizers expect about 55,000 EDM fans to take over Bayfront Park. So Miami police officers closed the section of Biscayne Boulevard in both directions from Thursday night to 7 a.m. Monday. Mr. Fackler, the month of March has pretty much been, it's worked its way out as spring break month. There's been a lot of talk leading up to what was going on in Miami Beach. I was effectively a police state. There were curfews in place. There was $100 parking fee requirements. They were scanning everyone's tag or license plate as they drove onto the island for spring break in South Beach. There were DUI checkpoints, and there was a ton of arrests. Ultra, which took place in downtown Miami, sounds like it went off quietly. And I say that tongue in cheek because Ultra, the music just blasts. So, Mr. Factor, why don't you give us your take as our resident social gathering expert, whether it be spring break or Ultra or anything, here for the Miami Reporters Roundtable podcast?
Well, I'd like to push back a little bit on this story.
Okay.
I have a confession to make. I became a troll, Ultra troll. I trolled the X site of Ultra, where a lot of the participants, you know, they rave about the different sets and they talk about how great the music was. I can tell you, every three posts was somebody complaining about they got robbed. They got their phone stolen. They got their wallet stolen. I was shocked. And I was like, wow, I guess they had a lot of issues despite, you know, the security measures in place. So then I read this story and I was shocked because it's talking about only a few arrests. And perhaps maybe the reporters could have pushed back a little bit here and got some numbers for the 3 days for the festival to see what the total amounts of, you know, arrests were compared to the previous year. Maybe you could show there that there was maybe an improvement. But I mean, listen, just a couple of days earlier, there was a looting of a Hermes handbag in Miami Beach store that I believe is a boutique that's in one of the hotels there. Over $1.5 million of handbags was stolen. Somebody pulled up, two guys, they took 100 handbags, middle of the freaking day, took off. And it's like, you know, we talked a little bit about this last year. Was there a movement in crime in general that, you know, that crime was getting too much in Miami Beach and a lot of stores were starting to open up in downtown? And maybe this is more of, you know, according to this reporting, more of an indication of that happening. Problems on Miami Beach, less problems in downtown. Last year when we talked about this, I took a beating from viewers and, you know, people were just up my ass about, you know, what are you talking about, this and that. I don't want to toot my own horn because it might be just, you know, a one-off or a two-off. But, yeah, I thought that that was pretty interesting about, you know, seeing all these boots on the ground at Ultra saying, I'm getting robbed. Everywhere I turn around, there's crooks everywhere.
So, Mr. Fackler, there's a lot there to unpack. Point number one, if somebody got their phone ripped off, how were they able to post that they got robbed? So I just put that out there. That's sort of.
Listen, I'm just telling you what they were saying. Just to push back on that a little bit. Most people don't come to Ultra alone. They come with groups. The girls come together. The guys come together. Maybe somebody else's phone was able to post that. So that's my little pushback.
All right. That's fine. So let's also talk about, you said $1.5 million in luxury handbags were ripped off in Miami Beach during spring
break.
Over
100 handbags. And obviously, very highfalutin boutique fashion brand, Hermes, I believe. And so they know what they were looking for. I mean, the poor guy showed up, I don't know, afterwards, and he was like, what happened? Somebody came in and they broke through the window or whatever and took 100 bags. So you got this
Mr.
happening.
Mr. Fackler,
you
know. But there was a curfew in Miami Beach. Was this during the day or?
I believe from the, you know, I'd have to reread it. I can't tell you offhand.
I don't have a story in front of me. That's fine.
But it might have been during the day.
Mr. Fackler, I'm wondering, though, if Miami Beach was pretty much a police state and I was down there early in March, they had streets closed and stuff like that. There were cops everywhere and they weren't just Miami Beach police. They were from all jurisdictions in and around the state of Florida. Did the story say about how these people were able to like avoid this huge police presence?
Not really, but apparently the criminals pulled off a very similar scam last year. So they were able to quickly find them and arrest them. So there was some sort of...
Oh, arrest were made.
Yeah, I believe arrests were made, yes. And
interesting.
Yeah, by the way, to your point, there were no murders this year. And, you know, last spring break, there were a couple of killings, a couple of shootings at the cafes. So there were no reports of any shootings this year. So that's a plus.
So Mr. Fackler, is that a nod then to week two of the podcast when Donna Huffinger Evans made the point that spring break was really under control in Miami Beach this year versus maybe what you thought at the time?
Yeah, I agree with Donna now.
Okay. Donna, if you're watching, Mr. Fackler's come across to come around to your side. Fantastic.
Because she ripped me a new one last week. I know.
All right. And then final point, Mr. Fackler. It sounds like what you were saying is that Miami Beach, it's got a lot of challenges versus downtown Miami and the city of Miami, which seem to be handling Ultra and its social gathering much better than maybe what we saw in Miami Beach. Is that the takeaway from the month of March in 2024 from your perspective as an expert on social gatherings and everything spring break and Ultra?
Yes, definitely my takeaway. Absolutely.
Okay. Fantastic. Anybody else on the podcast want to comment on $1.5 million in luxury handbags getting swiped, alleged iPhone and cell phone theft going on at Ultra, or just the overall state of the month of March and spring break and Ultra? Well, anybody have any comments?
I think it, you know, sounds like a bunch of people having fun. But you know, if you got if people, if their cell phone was stolen, are they going to report it? That may skew the data. And two, Ultra is a contained event. Spring Break, you know, with an entrance and exit. Spring Break isn't. So I'm sure the metrics. I don't know. I could be. I'm not a social gathering SME like others.
Like Mr. Pac,
subject matter expert, but it seems like, I mean, you know, I don't know.
Well, these festivals are ripe for pickpockets. I mean, they are okay.
Pickpockets.
Exactly. Make a generalization exactly. here, but most of the attendees are in altered states, and so I don't think they're paying attention to their phones or belongings, and they're just like easy pickings, man. So, I mean, I'm not surprised that a lot of stuff disappeared.
Exactly.
The professionals.
Yeah, he's dead on because, you know, of the few arrests they made, it was pickpocketing, it was theft, it was exactly what he's talking about. So, you know, they're easy pickings if they're out of their minds, you know.
Interesting. Okay, let's go on to Jean Grusewitz story number four. Jean, this is a piece that comes out of The Real Deal. I'm going to read you the headline for a couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Let me give some history before I get into it. Basically, 3 years ago, we had a collapse of a condo tower called the Champlain Tower South in Surfside. Surfside disaster, a lot of people refer to it as. Nearly 100 people died. $1 billion settlement was ultimately paid out to the families of everyone who was involved. In the collapse. As a result, insurance prices have gone dramatically higher. The state of Florida and local government bodies have stepped up, and now they're really scrutinizing the structural integrity of buildings. And as a result, what we're finding is that association dues are going up tremendously. Many old buildings, they can't necessarily, nor do they possibly want to go through the process of making their buildings safe. So now many are looking to cash out, looking to sell off their condo units in one move. A bulk move, if you will, to an individual buying group. And that buying group will simply terminate the condominium, which is notify the state that the condominium no longer exists, knock down the structure and put up something brand new. So that's kind of the background, Sean. So when somebody buys one of these condominiums, buys all the units out, even if there's 300 units in the building, but if there's one buyer, they're referring to it as a condo buyout. So that's kind of the background. Here we go with the headline. First couple graphs coming out of The Real Deal. Condo buyouts just got trickier. Ruling over condo termination could kill some buyout deals in the works. And first couple graphs, Jean. Florida's 3rd District Court of Appeals sided with a group of unit owners seeking to block demolition of their condo building in Edgewater, a waterfront Miami neighborhood where development has been booming. The unit owners who filed a lawsuit over the condo termination of Biscayne 21 alleged that an affiliate of Two Roads Development illegally amended the association's condo declaration to change the threshold to terminate the association from 100% to only 80%. Current state law allows developers to terminate with 80% approval, though 5% can block that vote. That's why many looked to lock up just over 95% support. Biscayne 21's declaration predated current law. So why does this matter? Well, for Two Roads, which is seeking a rehearing, has filed to take the issue to Florida Supreme Court. It poses a major threat to the future of its planned development. Jean, what do you make of that? Lo and behold, this group has gone forward. They thought they had a termination. They thought they were going to be able to peddle condominiums and the brand new development that's likely to go up on the site of this structure. I don't know the particulars or the history of this particular deal, but I can tell you from having covered real estate for years in Florida, these kinds of deals are not easy to pull off, and a lot of times you have a very small group of people in these condos that will object or try to hold out for a better price. And meanwhile, developers want to pay as little as possible to be able to control what happens to the development. So, you know, there's sort of a push and pull there's always going to be that kind of friction. And I think from the developer standpoint, what I've noticed is a lot of these deals in general fail because of lack of communication. And trying to get the residents on board, and they'll go about it sometimes in a sneaky way, try to control as many units as they can, change the rules, and then hope that the holdouts disappear. Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. I really don't know anything about this particular case, so I'm not talking about that case, but I've seen that happen before, and a few intransigent owners can really screw up a deal. And I'm a little surprised in the story itself that it says that they already started pre-sales of these condos without having locked it up. And I'm finding that like pretty surprising, because, you need to have control of the building before you start pre-sales.
100%, John, 100%. You know, John, this sort of reminds me, if you remember back in the early 2000s, there was this mobile home community located right on the ocean in Delray Beach, Florida, just south of Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach County, where former President Trump has his facility. This place called Briny Breeze. Some developer came in, offered $1 million a lot, basically to pack up your mobile home and get it the hell out. And everybody could piss off with their $1 million and do whatever they want to do. And there were a couple of people who sort of jammed it up. And lo and behold, once the deal got back on schedule or on the path, the market changed on them. And now everybody was stuck with their mobile home so many years later, it's still never gotten developed. I just wonder, Sean, is there a possibility, given where we are in the marketplace, this type of contention, if a project, and you don't have to talk about this one specifically, but generally speaking, if you're going forward with something and it gets knocked off keel and the market suddenly changes and a developer has a chance to maybe reconsider whether or not they actually want to take this down at the current price, because in the future it might actually be cheaper if prices fall. All the wisdom you might be able to share as somebody who's lived in Florida forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, if you're getting a sweet deal to move out of your condo, to sell your condo from a developer, and you're at the peak of the market, take it. I mean, I don't know why these guys are holding out. You know, we're definitely closer to the end of the cycle than we are at the beginning. So, I mean, this, if you're going to sell, this is the time to sell. And perhaps you may have missed it. I mean, the way things are going right now, you may have missed the peak. And these holdouts will look kind of dumb after. Maybe, I mean, only time will tell, of course.
Only time will tell. Anyone else on the panel want to chime in on whether, A, are we already past the peak and these people should take the cash for this old shitty condominium building? And I feel like I can say that because I've been in it, I've known it, I've seen it. It's a crappy old structure. Everybody's pretty much packed their stuff and left. If you can get that kind of money to piss off, I don't know why you don't. Mr. Packler, anybody have a comment?
No, I agree. I'd take it right now. Take it and go.
Take the cash.
Take the cash. Story number five. We're going to go to Forrest Jones. Forrest, this piece coming out of CNBC. I'm going to read you the headline first. A couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline: the Fed hasn't touched interest rates since July, but they're still moving. What that looks like for credit cards, mortgages, and savings accounts. And here's three key points that CNBC has in its piece. Then I'll read you the story, and I want you to comment. Interest rates for credit cards are likely to continue elevated levels for the rest of 2024, even if the Federal Reserve cuts rates. Point number two, rates for savings accounts continue to be high, but likely won't stay there much longer. And point number three, rates for home mortgages could continue to moderate as the year progresses. And now, first couple graphs, Forrest, and I want you to comment. Inflation in the U.S. has hit a speed bump. While the rate of price increases has come down significantly from its peak in the summer of 2022, the most recent reading from the Consumer Price Index showed overall inflation stuck at just above 3%. Core inflation, which removes volatile food and energy prices from the index, was even higher at 3.8%. For perspective, the Fed's inflation target is only 2%. Those higher than expected readings dash most hopes that the U.S. Federal Reserve would begin cutting interest rates this spring, as many central banker watchers hope they might after nearly 2 years of steady rate increases. Mr. Jones, just kind of lay it out for the general public, and I'm not an economist, but I've sort of paid attention to this a long time. Basically, when the Fed cuts interest rates, the economy goes up. And when the Fed increases interest rates, the economy slows down. It's like it's a yin and a yang. It's kind of like a teeter-totter. Now, a lot of people were talking going into 2024 that there was probably going to be 5 rate cuts, possibly 6 rate cuts going on in 2024 to try to bolster the economy. But what the economy has shown that is continuing to hum, the stock market's humming. And now there's talk of 6 projected rate increases. Now it's down to 3. And I heard an interview today from the former head of Morgan Stanley. He's anticipating there won't be any rate cuts this year. Forrest, can you kind of lay it out for the general public? What could we see in 2024?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve, what they're doing is engineering a soft landing here. So yes, that yin and the yang argument, it applies, but when it moves, the effects tend to take place months later, in terms of savings and credit cards and things like that. Inflation is still high. 3.2% is above the general target at 2. Even the core inflation rate, which they want, is still fairly high. So they haven't touched rates in July. People are still saying 3 cuts in 2024. So they may hold off any longer. Eventually they will do it. GDP is up. It was okay. Fourth quarter in 2023 was 3.2. Because of still elevated consumer debt, because of lingering high interest rates, that's eventually going to take, it's going to drag on recovery. And the government is predicting Q4 2024 to grow at 1.1%. So we'll have 3.2% growth to 1.1. That's cooling. That's cooling economy. Considering we were looking for everyone was worried about a recession, it looks like they're successful in generating this this soft landing. The thing is, inflation's it's coming from a lot of things. Some people will scream about stimulus measures, pandemic era, let's not, since 2008, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has grown. If you include quantitative easing, that's when the Fed goes in and actually buys debt, or what's known as Operation Twist, is when they swap out one length of maturity for another one. The whole combined effort is added $13.35 trillion on their balance sheet since 2024.
That's a T, trillion.
Not all of that, and not only is that new money, but most of it is injected in, just injecting the economy. That's going to have an inflationary impact. You consider that, you consider the war in Ukraine on gasoline, other factors, supply chain snags, and you realize it's a complicated story. To engineer monetary policy, we might cool to 1.1% growth. Pretty good. And then get back to around 2% growth in 2025. So, I'm not an economist. No one knows what's going to happen, but, a talk of hyperinflation, talk of going into an abyss, has just not.
So Forrest, one of the, and again, I'm not an accountant, but one category when the Fed's inflation numbers always come out, they're always talking about is real estate. And I've noticed just driving around, and I know by running statistics, it looks like the rental market is starting to get soft. It looks like there's a lot of people looking to rent places. I'm seeing signs in medians. I'm seeing signs on telephone poles, stoplight poles. If I'm kind of walking in and around, I'm just wondering, do you have any take? Have you seen anything with the rental market? You live over in the Brickell Avenue area. Have you noticed anything? Are we starting to see a pullback in the real estate market? Because once real estate starts to pull back, that's probably going to go a long way towards trying to get the inflation closer to that 2% rate that the Fed's striving for. So any thoughts on that?
I'll just talk from personal experience. I renewed my lease and it was a slight bump up, but not nearly what it was about a couple of years ago when you heard horror stories, literally around Brickell, like people's rent going up $1,000 or more.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, this is people talking, but you hear a lot of talk like that. Spiking. It seems to be, a little more stable, at least the rental market around here.
What kind of bump did you see in your rent, percentage-wise?
I saw between a little over inflate, 6 to 12%.
Okay, so it's a push for inflation. Got it.
Yeah, it's just slightly over it.
Yeah. So let me also ask you, Forrest, when, and it's interesting you mentioned that because I was reading a report. Somebody had written about a company, a REIT that owns single family homes and they turn around and rent them. And when the company had its Q4 conference call, they talked about how they were worried about 2024. So they offered incentives in late 2023 to try to tie people up for another year because they were afraid that they were going to suffer a spike in vacancies in 2024 if they didn't sign these people up early. So, Forrest, I guess what I'm wondering is when you went in to renew and you have a corporate landlord, how they treat you? What was the experience like? And could you contrast that to maybe previously?
No, they wanted me there. I went back and negotiated and got some lower, some adjustments on the rate. I forget the exact price increase I played. I'm up a little higher. I've got higher ceilings than mine and a nice view of the bay. But they didn't roll out the red carpet, but they did. But the other end of that story though, it's run by AIMCO, a massive company that owns lots of properties.
Correct.
Is rent low enough now where I was? This is what I was, you pay attention, rents are going to fall. Was it lower enough to offset the headaches and costs of moving? Because then I'm going to have to pay 3 months down, all that. I don't have to do that here. And correct. I can break my lease. You get these little clauses in. So I got these tangibles and intangible benefits of stay. That said, if I had to do it again, if I wanted to rent again, if they further correct rental prices, then I might have made a different decision. But at the time when I renew the lease, the monetary benefit of staying place benefited me. But yeah, they were nice. They were good.
Awesome. Congratulations. Jean, Mr. Fackler, yeah. Any of you want to comment?
I have a couple of observations. A building about two blocks away from Forrest, my old building, used to have about, on average 10 or 12 rentals in the building. And I just checked the other day and there are more than 40. So a quadrupling. And a lot of these units are dropping their rents, which were, had gotten to stratospheric levels. But I use that building sort of like a canary in a coal mine. And it's clear that there's an oversupply. And honestly, there's a tsunami of apartments being built right now in Miami-Dade. And that's just going to swamp the area with supply. And I anticipate rents are going to drop significantly. But the other thing I wanted to say was, why does anybody believe what the Fed says? I mean, they completely missed the inflation call. I mean, they completely flubbed it.
Transitory. It was transitory.
It was hardly transitory.
They just didn't say how long the transitory period was.
And then they raised rates at 100 miles an hour, because they realized they'd made a terrible mistake. I mean, it almost seems like they're just sort of going from one stance to another, and nobody really knows what they're going to do. And it's an election year, so that makes it even more complicated. So the Morgan Stanley economist who said that he doesn't expect any rate cuts this year. I think he's right. I don't think there are going to be any rate cuts this year. Inflation is still high. I mean, we have look at the stock market, look at all the cranes outside. I mean, all kinds of projects are getting financed. All kind of nonsense is getting financed. Crypto's back. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's just crazy. That's crazy.
But unemployment's still an issue. So they may, there's a dual mandate, unemployment price in an election year. And that jawbony is a monetary tool in itself.
Yeah, but I mean, unemployment is still super low. I mean, it's relatively low.
It's still low.
We haven't had the mass layoffs that, generally accompany a downturn. I don't know.
Jean, I wanted to mention, you'd referenced what I said about Morgan Stanley. It's actually James Gorman, the former president, who retired, and now he's serving on the chair, as a chairman for the board.
But Sean, can you tell us which building you use as canary in the coal mine?
No.
Or are you going to give away some sort of proprietary approach?
No, because I still have friends in there. I don't want to ask.
Who own or they rent?
They own. And
That's why. Yeah, understood. Yeah. Understood.
Yeah, but I think it's not unique to that building. I think we're seeing like a surge in rental inventory and prices are coming down. And as you said, there are signs all over the place. You just walk around. I mean, I walked around the other day. There's signs, apartments for rent, you know, in a lot of windows.
Yep.
So I think your sense is right that there is a supply. Obviously that would be good for Miami's inflation rates because it will bring down rents. And I think we're starting to see that happen.
Great conversation. Mr. Fackler, we're going to go to you with story number six, Mr. Fackler. It's coming out of the Miami Herald. One of the issues that we constantly talk about on this podcast is all the fraud associated with condominium associations. Anybody doesn't know, an association in the state of Florida, generally speaking, it's an unpaid position. People volunteer. They live in a building. They serve on a board. And basically, it's a lot of grief. I was on a board for 3 years. I can tell you, it's a pain in the ass. You don't get anything but maybe some free stickers that you can, or free parking stickers. So when somebody comes to visit you, otherwise, that's all you do is get grief. You go to the pool, everybody's up your ass complaining about something. You're in the elevator that complained. So it's a job nobody wants. However, there are some who actually want the job. And the reason they want it is there's all kind of alleged fraud going on, kickbacks. Their brother-in-law gets a contract, this and that, cronyism, things like that. So that's the background, Mr. Fackler. And I'm going to go ahead and read you the headline for a couple of graphs, and I want you to turn around and provide your insights. So here we go. Miami Herald headline: fraud charges at Kendall Condo Association illustrate the need for effective safeguards. And this is actually an op-ed piece that was written by an attorney specialist in condo associations. And she wrote into the Miami Herald, but I thought it was kind of interesting given how much we talk about fraud at associations. So here we go, Mr. Fackler. Alleged thefts at community associations during the last couple of years in Miami-Dade County, Southwest Florida, and other parts of the state have shined a spotlight on fraud in condominium associations and HOAs, which are homeowners associations. New laws that add teeth to the criminal and civil penalties for association fraud were unanimously approved by both chambers of the Florida legislature and now await the governor's signature. And these reforms could help the associations that have been victimized. Mr. Fackler, I'll let you sort of discuss what this attorney lays out in terms of how associations can sort of protect themselves and individuals who own in building can protect themselves against some of this fraud. So what was your overall takeaway?
Well, I think a lot of it was helpful as far as, the idea here is that you want to stop any type of fixing elections to secure board seats. That's been an issue. Some of the safeguards is to bar any one individual or company from gaining full control over a community's finances. And what's happening in the case that you just mentioned as well, what is being required is multiple signatories to issue checks, to withdraw funds, make changes to bank accounts, vendor contracts, even insurance policies. Because what's happening is some of these crooks are convincing owners to sign over checks or vendors with one signature. And that was the issue here. So if you have multiple signatories, that would pretty much, put the kibosh on that whole idea. They're also saying that there should be audits, which we've talked about several times a year. Also insurance for criminal malfeasance, something that I don't think people realize. I mean, there's so much criminal malfeasance going on, maybe you need insurance for that. And they actually have insurance policies for that. So, it's really kind of interesting as far as the different things they can do. I was curious, though. I did not see much about protections for the actual individual residents. Now, I know when they approved this HB 919 last year, it was a 60-page bill. It was reduced to 17 pages. And the biggest thing they had in that was a statewide task force, where residents can actually complain, call in, And that was stripped out of the bill. And also, and that's the most important thing, right, for a resident. And then also, there was a felony, the idea of there could be felonies, because you notice they talk about criminal charges. No longer felonies, it's a misdemeanor.
So a misdemeanor to commit fraud at a condo association.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's, you know, where's the deterrence? I don't see a deterrence. And I know Jean has mentioned this in the past. He studied this issue. This has really been going on for decades. Why is now all of a sudden that, you know, there's been reforms instituted? Is it possible because there's been spotlight on it from the media? Perhaps that's what it is.
Jean, any thoughts?
A lot of HOAs are criminal organizations.
I think I let Jean say that instead of me.
I mean, do you have any? Yeah, that's the bottom line. And is there any sign? And we talked about this the first episode of this season,
right?
But you know, there was some stuff taken by the legislature,
but it doesn't sound like they went far.
No, it's just tinkering around the edges. Oh. What needs to happen is HOAs need to fall under the Sunshine Law, so that all their documents, all their records are open to public inspection, open records laws by the public. So anyone can look at them, buyers, sellers, owners, renters, anybody should be able to look at the condo docs, look at the financial audits of these HOA associations. And I think,
absolutely.
And I think the more light we shine on them, public light, the less likely they are to do these shenanigans in the darkness, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for a fantastic podcast. Let me go ahead and thank Jean Bruce. Jean, you were a journalist for 25 years. Right now, you have your own public relations marketing firm called Bruce Communications. People can check you out at brucepr.com. They can also get you on X, which is formerly Twitter, at Jean Bruce, JeanGruss. I want to thank John Fackler. John was a journalist for over 20 years. Right now, just about public relations and marketing. You want to get a hold of John, get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. And I want to thank Forrest Jones. Forrest was a journalist for over 15 years. Right now, he's in the fintech industry. He's also an author. He published one book. He's working on a second one. You want to get a hold of Forrest, you can get him on X at AFJ3. And Forrest, why don't you give the audience a reminder of the name of your current book and where they can get it at?
Yeah, it's called The Placebo Agenda, and it's available on most outlets, Amazon, Apple Books, bookbaby.com. You can find it.
Wonderful. And let me remind you, I'm Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. If you have any comments for us, go ahead and get us on X. Send us a message at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. Remember, not AARP. And also, too, don't forget my company, the sponsor of this podcast, condovultures.com. Any kind of statistics you need, and I'd encourage you to go ahead and sign up for our newsletter. It's a weekly newsletter. So until next time, I hope everybody takes care of yourself, and we'll catch up soon. Ciao, ciao.
It's a simple formula, and it works. Buy low, sell high. We're Condo Vultures, and when it comes to your real estate, we help you buy low. At Condo Vultures, we represent the buyer, and now's the time to buy. Log on to condovultures.com for more information. Condovultures.com. And remember, before you sell high, you have to buy low. Featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, and Time Magazine. Condo Vultures Realty, a licensed Florida real estate brokerage capitalizing on the condo correction since 2006.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures Podcast. Before I started doing these podcasts, I was in the business of being a licensed real estate broker, a contributing columnist for the Miami Herald, as well as the Miami Real Deal, but also extra witness work in consulting. So if you are looking for an expert witness, or if you're looking for consulting services, a straight talk perspective as to what's going on in a particular marketplace, a building, or what happened previously, for whatever your situation is, whether you are an attorney, whether you are a institutional fund looking to invest, or whether you're a lender who's trying to come up with some sort of a strategy and approach for your lending committee going forward, I don't just might be able to help you. To get a hold of me, please reach out to peter@condovultures.com. That's peter@condovultures.com. Or give me a call to the office at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859.